Chapter 18. They assembled in Hay's study promptly at 10 a.m. and took the same seats they'd occupied the night before. John Hay behind his broad desk, Clarence King and Henry James in leather wingback chairs set on both sides of the desk and still turned toward the wall of books where the screen had been. King was grumbling. Hay looked embarrassed that this was happening in his home. The internationally renowned wordsmith Henry James kept his mouth shut. At 10 minutes after 10, King said,
"What the hell? That impertinent Norwegian orders us, to be at his beck and call at 10 a.m., and then he doesn't show up? I've boxed men's ears for less."
"Benson told me that Sigerson left the house very early this morning."
"Very early," said Hay.
"And Benson said that he was carrying his portmanteau."
"Have you counted the silver?" said King.
James concentrated on not speaking. He'd gone to Sigerson's room at 8 that morning, only to find the room empty. His first impulse had been also to pack and flee, but then he realized that the imposter's absence might give him a way to make things right with John and Clara, perhaps even with King if the Norwegian lunatic did not reappear. At 10:15, all three men stood.
"I see no need," began Hay.
"If he thinks," began King.
James was straightening his waistcoat and trying to get his thoughts in proper alignment. A stranger stepped into the room and closed the door behind him. It took even Henry James, who'd met the man in this form only a few years before, to see that it was Sherlock Holmes. The Sigerson makeup had disguised the Englishman more than James had given it credit for. Holmes was now in a proper British suit. His hair was now brown, not black, and receding much more dramatically than had Sigerson's spiky top. With the mustache and makeup around the nose and eyes removed, this version of Sigerson Holmes looked even leaner, a face that seemed all sharp cheekbones, deep shadows, hawk nose, strong chin, and those piercing eyes.
"Be seated, gentlemen," said Holmes.
His upper-class British accent had returned.
"And thank you for coming."
"Who?"
began John Hay.
"Who do you?"
said Clarence King. Holmes closed the door behind him and motioned with palms out for them to sit.
"Everyone here but Mr. James, who has some hint of the truth, knew me the last few days as Jan Sigerson. My true name is Sherlock Holmes. I'm a consulting detective. Until 2 years ago, I lived in London. I went to Nepal in 1891 and have now come to Washington in service of Her Majesty's government and in the vital interest of the government of the United States of America."
There was babble and outrage. Clarence King shouted until servants came knocking at the door, inquiring as to whether everything was all right. Hay sent them away. Only James had remained seated. For a few moments, he felt anesthetized, totally immobilized, and during those moments he was convinced that either he had died in Paris, in the Seine that Sunday night, or the deep melancholy that had driven him to France and the Seine 2 weeks earlier had driven him quite mad. Madness was the only logical explanation for what he was experiencing now. "But is it my madness, or this Sigerson Holmes's?" Holmes waited until the outcry died down, and at least John Hay sat back in his chair. Clarence King still stood and paced, his hands clenched into fists, his usually amiable expression now frozen into a frightening scowl.
"In the spring of 1891, Edward Hooper, you all knew him as Ned, hired me to look into the circumstances of his sister's death in 1885, and the fact that every year on the anniversary of her death, he and each of you has received one of these."
Holmes removed from his tweed jacket not one, but 6 of the "She Was Murdered" typed cards and handed the short stack to John Hay, whose expression of surprise almost instantly changed to one of shock.
"Ned is dead," snapped Clarence King. "A suicide like his sister 7 years before him."
"I know that Ned Hooper is dead," said Holmes. I do not yet know, none of us here know, if either his death or his sister Clover's was so simple as suicide. Everyone agreed that Clover's death was suicide, snapped King, taking an aggressive step toward Holmes, who watched the shorter but stouter man with what seemed to be complete calm. Holmes removed his black clay pipe and with a "may I" to Hay, who nodded distractedly, fussed with lighting it. At least, based on the scent when it was lit, the tobacco was not that cheapest of shags he'd used near James a few times on the ship and train.
Clover took potassium cyanide when she was alone in her house, continued King, who waved away the stack of cards when Hay tried to pass them to him. Ned Hooper tried twice to kill himself, once by throwing himself in front of a trolley, and finally threw himself from a high window of the sanatorium. Some called it an asylum, to which he'd been referred.
But no one we know of saw either Mrs. Adams's death by potassium cyanide or her brother Ned's actual throwing himself from the window, said Holmes between slow puffs that seemed to be further antagonizing King.
You don't need to see the snow falling to know it snowed if you go to sleep outside in the mountains on dry grass and wake up under a coating of new snow, growled King.
Very good, said Holmes. I applaud the use of inductive logic. However, in this case, we have a brother and sister dead, supposedly by their own hand, but in neither case need it be suicide. Mrs. Clover Adams became quite good friends with a Miss Rebecca Lorne in the year before she died. Is this not true?
What? Snapped King.
She did, said John Hay. I met Miss Lorne on several occasions. A pleasant lady. And this was the lady who was waiting outside Mr. Adams' former home when he came home to find his wife dead upstairs. Is this not correct? Said Holmes. He relit the pipe. So what? Said Hay, sounding angry himself now. Miss Lorne visited Clover almost every day in those last months. She was waiting outside when Adams was about to go to his appointment that morning. Or perhaps when he came back for something, I forget which. At any rate, Miss Lorne did not find the body. Poor Henry did.
And Miss Lorne moved away from Washington a month or so after Clover Adams's death? Holmes's voice was soft but persistent.
Yes, to Baltimore, said Hay, where she married a Mr. Bell some months later, by the summer of 1886, I believe. Henry still corresponded with her in the years after Clover's death. Perhaps he still does from time to time. I doubt it very much, said Holmes. I believe the woman you knew as Miss Rebecca Lorne was murdered shortly after she left Washington, perhaps before.
You're mad, said Clarence King.
Wait a minute, said Hay. Let's discuss this performance of the past few days and last night, in which you claimed to be an explorer named Jan Sigerson. What on earth was that about?
A necessary ruse, said Holmes. There was a third leather chair empty, one facing Hay's desk, and he sat in it.
Those who have been hunting me knew that I would come to honor Ned Hooper's request. Those who have been hunting you, said Hay.
Damned slow about getting here, said King. You say Hooper, you have no right to call him Ned, whoever you are, asked you to come help him with this cards thing in the spring of 91. Yet here you are showing up in the spring of 93, months after Ned killed himself. Good thing you're not a fireman or a policeman.
I am a policeman, in a manner of speaking, Holmes said quietly. He had sprawled into the deep chair with one leg thrown carelessly over the other. Henry James finally found his voice. He deliberately spoke to Hay and King, not to the man sitting opposite him.
Last night we received, from Mr. Volebeck and his family, near conclusive proof that this man, in makeup or not, is the Norwegian explorer Jan Sigerson.
We heard the Norwegian language spoken fluently between them. We heard His Excellency Mr. Volbeck speak of Norwegian friends he and Sigerson had in common. We then saw the slides of Sigerson's expedition into Tibet, including the photograph from Bombay of Sigerson with the younger explorer, Sven Anders Heden, known to all three of the Volbecks. It seems to me that the only sane conclusion we can draw here is that this man has long been pretending to be the English detective Sherlock Holmes. Perhaps the high altitude in the Himalayas affected his mind. Holmes removed the pipe from his mouth and chuckled.
My dear James, do you accept the legerdemain of a theatrical magician with as much eager credulity as you did my bona fides for being Jan Sigerson?
James felt himself flushing with anger and embarrassment, but he forced his voice to remain calm, reasonable, and civilized.
There was no reason for Mr. Volebeck and his wife and daughter to perjure themselves with...
There was one excellent good reason, my dear James, said Holmes, standing again and prodding the air with the stem of his pipe. As soon as I learned that I'd be dining with the Volebecks on Sunday the 26th, I cabled King Oscar II of Scandinavia and asked him to have his Norwegian emissary support my story and disguise. You see, I still have use for Explorer Sigerson. Mr. Volebeck is giving interviews to reporters from the Washington Post and a writer from the Washington Critic, even as we speak, telling all about his delightful evening with his fellow countryman Sigerson at the home of Mr. John Hay. So you get the King of Scandinavia to do your bidding with a cable? Said Clarence King, who decided to sit down in the chair Holmes had just vacated. Including having one of the most respected diplomats in Washington and his wife and daughter lie to two people so respected as John Hay and Henry James? And you expect us to believe that?
Believe what you will, Holmes said carelessly. He'd crossed to a window and opened the slats of the louvered wooden shutters and was peering out onto the street.
The dialogue in Norwegian, said Henry James.
Was far from fluent on my part, said Holmes,
half turning from the window so that his rather distinctive silhouette was visible against the light.
My greatest fear that the daughter, young Oda, despite being coached by her father to go along with the fiction that I was Norwegian, would blurt out a criticism of my pathetic Norwegian, most of which I picked up while spending time with His Majesty King Oscar II in London for 2 months, in 1888, and again for 9 weeks in the winter spring of 1891, shortly before my death at Reichenbach Falls.
You must have handled a very delicate domestic problem, King said sarcastically, to put European royalty so deeply into your debt.
I did, actually, said Holmes. But that is not the reason that His Majesty the King of Scandinavia ordered his emissary to lie during a social occasion. Rather, King Oscar II well knows the reasons both for my mission to Tibet and my mission here in Washington. He knows the enemies we face, and they are his enemies as well, gentlemen. Should these people have their way, His Majesty is on a long and distinguished list of targets who will be murdered in the next few months or years.
Clarence King sighed and steepled his fingers.
These people. Now we have the conspiracy talk and the paranoia. Are there no traits of madness you will not trot out for our distraction, Mr. Whoever you are?
Holmes laughed almost boyishly at King's comment. Without answering, he fished in his inside jacket pocket and removed what looked to be 4 photographs. Setting 2 of them back in his pocket, he handed the first of the 2 remaining photos to King.
Would you hand that around to Mr. Hay and Mr. James? Thank you.
James waited. When the photograph finally came his way, he saw that it was almost certainly blown up in size, since the subject was in 2/3 profile against a grainy and blurry background of a crowded street. The photo was of a dark-complexioned man with black hair brushed straight back, a carefully trimmed mustache that looked rather military in origin, and fiercely angled eyebrows. The man looked to be in his late 40s or early 50s, but only a tendency toward jowls betrayed his age.
"That is Colonel Sebastian Moran, a veteran of the Indian Army and formerly of the 1st Bangalore Pioneers. He was mentioned in various dispatches during the different Afghan wars, received a medal for killing 9 Afghans in a hand-to-hand fight in Kabul, and was considered by many to be the finest hunter and rifle marksman in Asia, perhaps in the world. His full name is John Sebastian Tiger Jack Moran, although very few people know that."
"Colonel Sebastian Moran," muttered Clarence King when James handed the photograph back to him.
"By God, I read his books, Heavy Game of the Western Himalayas and 3 Months in the Jungle, Hunting Memoirs, and Cracking Good Tales."
Holmes, now standing with his back to the window, nodded. "He published both of those in the early 1880s. He gave his publisher his birth date as being 1840, but in truth it was 1834. Colonel Moran will be 60 years old next February."
"He certainly does not look that old in the photograph," said John Hay. "When was the photo taken?"
"A year and a half ago, in Calcutta," said Holmes. "You see, Colonel Moran followed me to India from Switzerland in order to assassinate me. He was paid quite a large amount of money for my assassination. Assassination is the Colonel's major source of income, just ahead of guiding fat, rich gentlemen hunters to where they can kill dangerous animals, and far ahead of his less taxing profession of separating fat, rich gentlemen from their money at various card tables."
"Hired to kill you," sighed King. "And now comes the paranoia."
"Oh, yes," said Holmes. "Colonel Moran tried twice, once in Calcutta, again in Darjeeling, but was unsuccessful in both attempts. Then, having spent almost all of the money paid to him for the botched job, and not wanting to wait for me to re-emerge from Tibet, the good colonel returned to London. For one of the world's greatest hunters, Moran has surprisingly little patience."
"I fail to see what any of this has anything to do with," began John Hay. "Imagine my surprise, then, when I came back to Sikkim from Tibet, over the high passes, to be shot 3 times by a high-velocity rifle fired from almost a mile from my position."
The room fell thickly silent. James could hear a servant's shoes against carpet on the main staircase and a carriage passing outside.
"Shot 3 times by a high-velocity rifle," said Clarence King at last. "Then you are, must be, quite dead. So we have been dealing not only with a liar and imposter, but with a ghost."
King checked his watch. "And my time here is almost up. I must—"
He looked up, saw what Holmes was doing, and fell silent, aghast. Holmes had removed his jacket and waistcoat and collar and cravat, and was in the process of unbuttoning his shirt. John Hay stood.
"My dear sir—"
"This will only take a few seconds," said Holmes.
He was wearing no undershirt. He folded his shirt carefully across the back of the closest chair, turned sideways to the window, and opened the louvered shutters. For the second time, and even more clearly now, Henry James saw the 2 terrible round wounds on Holmes's upper right back near the shoulder blade. Entrance wounds, he believed they were called when caused by bullets, and the livid spiderweb tracery of scars radiating from them. There was a 3rd pattern of white scars just above the man's right hip. Holmes turned around so that the light fell on his chest and belly and right side. There was another cratered round scar, the exit wound, James had heard it called,
on Holmes's upper right chest, and below and to the left of it a few inches, a more complicated and ghastly scar, not circular, with even more scars radiating from it. Just above his right hip was the pattern of exit scars of the third wound. Holmes's long, white fingers touched each of the wounds, starting with the highest, just under his collarbone.
As I said, the assassin fired from almost a mile away and struck me 3 times, ratcheting the bolt action of his powerful rifle and firing 3 times in less than 2 seconds. This third wound,
he touched the latticework of scars above his hip,
struck me as I was falling.
He moved his fingers, which were as steady as a surgeon's, back up to the terrible white web of scarring of the second wound.
The second round did not pass through me, and my savior and surgeon, in this instance, had to dig it out. She started from the back and then realized that it was closer to the surface in the front, under my chest muscles. It was a long process, and she had no anesthetic.
She?
Clarence King said in a strangely dulled voice.
My savior and surgeon,
said Holmes, calmly putting his shirt back on.
She is an English missionary named Annie Royal Taylor, who had just made an attempt to travel to Lhasa. Her savior had spoken to her in a dream and said that her destiny was to carry Christ's word to Lhasa, the Dalai Lama, and to all of the Forbidden Kingdom. So Miss Annie Taylor had shaved her head and dressed herself in Tibetan male's clothing. But she was discovered far from Lhasa, turned back, and escorted back to the border by Tibetan guards. My own Tibetan helpers, assigned to me by His Holiness the Dalai Lama to escort me over the newly opened passes, had just bidden me farewell on the south side of the final pass, and were heading their ponies homeward north again, when they heard the 3 shots and were kind enough to return to where they'd last seen me. I was unconscious and bleeding badly. My Tibetan friends brought me to the nearby border trading post of Yatung. There was no doctor there, but the Tibetans and Sikkimese had grudgingly allowed Miss Taylor to take up residence nearby as she waited for her next covert attempt to enter Tibet. Perhaps the locals allowed her to stay there because her first name, Annie, sounds very much like the Tibetan word for nun. And so this missionary, who'd studied medicine and had occasion to practice it in the slums of London and again in China, staunched the bleeding, dug the second bullet out of me, and arranged blood transfusions that saved my life.
Incredible, whispered John Hay.
Yes, isn't it?
Agreed Holmes.
How do we know that those supposed scars aren't just more makeup?
Demanded Clarence King. Holmes had buttoned up his waistcoat and was in the act of sliding on his jacket when he paused.
Would you like to set your fingers into the wounds?
He asked softly.
You can, especially in the surgical incisions, almost up to the knuckle of your index finger. Here, I shall remove my shirt again.
No!
Cried King, waving for Holmes to stop the unbuttoning.
So are you saying that Colonel Sebastian Moran did wait through the winter and tried to assassinate you as you came down out of Tibet in the spring of 1892?
Said Hay.
Not at all, said Holmes, shooting his cuffs. This man is the one who shot me 3 times from so far away. He is perhaps the only marksman in the world who could have pulled off that shot, and he's long since displaced Colonel Sebastian Moran as the world's deadliest assassin.
He'd set the second photograph in his outside jacket pocket, but now he handed it to be circulated in their small circle. When it came to James, he was surprised to see a blurred photo of a much younger man than Moran, very short hair in a widow's peak, sharp cheekbones, ears close set to his head, eyes that appeared all black in the image.
You're looking at the only known photograph, taken on a busy Indian street by a British Secret Service agent in New Delhi, who was murdered the day after he sent that photograph to his superiors in Whitehall, of Colonel Sebastian Moran's son. It's a poor image,
but the only photograph police and intelligence services have of this young man. He was illegitimate, of course. Colonel Moran left a brace of bastards in his wake across India, Africa, Europe, and England. But this child was sired to a young adventuress in Warsaw. Surprisingly, Moran took the boy from his mother at a young age and raised him himself, dragging the boy around the world with him, and using the lad as a sort of gun carrier and general assistant in his Asian and other long hunting expeditions, and, I am sure, on more private missions of paid assassination. The boy learned quickly. His first name is Lucan. He has, in recent years, as I said, replaced his father as the most accomplished assassin the modern world has had the misfortune to know. But, totally unlike his father, he never kills for money. Lucan kills for his fanatical political beliefs. In this case, his goal and God is anarchy. In that sense, never assassinating his enemies for pay, he is as much unlike his father, Colonel Moran, as any man on earth could be. But they both ended up serving the same master in Sikkim along the border of Tibet. The international group of anarchists who first paid Colonel Moran to follow me to India in 1891, and then dispatched Lucan early the following year, after his father had failed. "Anarchists," muttered Clarence King. "Now comes the conspiracy." "A very real conspiracy, I'm afraid," said Holmes. "I was also skeptical about the international threat of anarchists when I came to America in September of 1881 to investigate your President Garfield's assassination. And, indeed, there was no direct conspiracy involved there. But I later became certain that Colonel Moran had been the assassin in the pay of the anarchist terrorists at Chicago's so-called Haymarket Square riots in 1886. The rifle shots that killed 3 of the 4 dead civilians and 4 of the 7 dead policemen were fired, I proved to the American police and authorities beyond any doubt, from a rooftop half a block from the square. Colonel Moran and one henchman, not Lucan, used the same modern level rifles that the colonel left behind in his attempt to assassinate Her Majesty in London the following year." "I've never read any of this anywhere," said Hay. "And you shan't," said Holmes, "at least until the anarchist threat against England, Europe, and the United States is dealt with."
"It seems a rather haphazard and random threat, Mr. Holmes," said Hay.
James thought, "Does John now believe that this is Sherlock Holmes with whom we're dealing?"
"Not haphazard or random at all in their scheming," said Holmes. "They have a list of presidents and royalty whom they plan to assassinate. In 1887, as I said, they hired Moran to assassinate Her Majesty Queen Victoria at her own Golden Jubilee. Moran came far too close to succeeding. He did leave his new LaBelle rifles, the first to use smokeless ammunition, behind in London, and using certain techniques I've refined over the years, I was able to ascertain that it was one of the same rifles used at Haymarket Square. The anarchists' list remains. They currently plan to have your President Cleveland assassinated on May 1st, opening day of the World's Columbia Exposition in Chicago. I need to stay here in America long enough to stop that."
"Moran, Senior or Junior?" asked King.
"What?" said Holmes.
"You said that Moran had tried to kill Queen Victoria 6 years ago," said King. "Colonel Moran, Senior or young Lucan Moran?"
"Oh, the only Moran we're dealing with is Colonel Moran, the father," said Holmes. "He never gave his son Lucan his name." "May I see that second photograph again?" asked John Hay.
Holmes, who'd received it from King after it had gone around the circle of 3 men, carried it over and set it on the leather desktop in front of Hay. "I know this man," whispered Hay. "He was Rebecca Lorne's, Clover Adams' good friend, Rebecca Lorne's young cousin, Clifton Richards,
also a photographer. Clover enjoyed talking to the young man about their shared art. "He bought her the new developing chemicals she used," said Holmes, not asking a question, "including the potassium cyanide solution."
"Yes, yes, I believe you are correct," said Hay in a pinched voice.
"I am," said Holmes.
He removed a third image from his jacket pocket and set it on the desk in front of Hay. James and King both stood and moved to Hay's side to peer down at the photo. It was obviously a professionally taken photograph, the kind done up for celebrities, and the woman was as beautifully dressed and attractive as any celebrity in any photograph James had ever seen. Her dark hair raised in an artful sculpture, her large, dark eyes dancing with subtle lighting, her full lips at the level of her beautiful hands that were raised to grasp the handle of the parasol that shaded her.
"Why, that's Rebecca Lorne, Clover's good friend during the last year of her life," said Hay. "She's younger here than when I knew her in the months before Clover's death, but I'm certain it's the same woman. Very attractive."
"Yes," said King. "I also met her then, this Rebecca. I remember that Clover first saw her from her window at the Adams's former house, the house where Clover died, the little white house at 1607 H Street, just down the block. Clover saw her walking alone in Lafayette Square daily for some weeks before she finally went down to introduce herself. After that, they were fast friends, even during Clover's long period of melancholy."
"And strangely," said Sherlock Holmes, "Mrs. Adams's melancholy only grew worse despite the best efforts of her new friend, Miss Lorne, and her young cousin Clifton, to cheer her up."
Henry James had never seen this woman before, but then he'd only heard about the delightful Rebecca Lorne in letters.
"I remember Adams saying that Clover had photographed her friend Rebecca several times," said Hay, touching the borders of the lovely woman's photograph.
"Ned Hooper told me that 2 years ago," Holmes said very quietly.
"And she photographed Cliff, Rebecca's cousin, as well," said Clarence King. "I saw work prints of photographs Clover had taken of the young man when they were all on a picnic in Rock Creek Park. She said that he should have been a good photographic subject, but she mustn't have clicked the shutter, probably because his head was almost always blurred in movement, despite her admonitions for her subjects to be still."
"Almost certainly a deliberate movement to blur his own features," murmured Holmes.
"But I believe that one or two images of the cousin came out," said King. "They just were not up to Clover's high standards."
"And Adams still has those photographs?" asked Holmes. "Of the cousin as well as Miss Lorne?"
"I'm sure he does," said John Hay.
"All labeled now and set away in archives."
"But he'll never let you see them," said Clarence King. "Adams can't speak about Clover, much less about her death, and he would never show her photographs to anyone, not even the ones she'd shared in public of her father, or of Henry, or of Richardson, their architect."
"That's why I need to get into Adams's house next door, with the servants out of the way, before Mr. Adams returns home in the coming week," said Holmes. "If Clover Adams achieved a clear photograph of Rebecca Lorne's nice young cousin Clifton, it will only be the second photograph the Secret Service or police services around the world will have of the anarchist's chief assassin, Colonel Moran's bastard son and brilliant protege, Lucan."
"If Clifton was this Lucan," said Hay, his perfectly manicured fingers still surrounding the photograph on his desktop,
"then who was Rebecca Lorne?"
"Lucan's mother, whom he murdered shortly after I believe they worked together to arrange the death of Clover Adams," said Holmes.
He took the photograph from Hay and carefully set it away in his jacket.
"This is an earlier photograph. I've had it for years, gentlemen, of Lucan's mother, the late American-born opera diva and actress,
and successful blackmailer named Irene Adler.
Chapter 19. Holmes was following his man on the afternoon train from Washington to New York City. The detective this afternoon was the perfect image of a poorly paid, mid-level bureaucrat or office worker. His dark suit was presentable, but only just. His shoes were shined, but down at the heel. His Homburg was brushed, but showing its age. His battered old briefcase was overstuffed with folders, papers, and pens. This particular bureaucrat was red-headed, with a mop of unruly curls escaping from the Homburg on every side, and red cheek whiskers, what the Americans had called sideburns, ever since a Civil War general named Burnsides had made them popular, coming almost to the corner of his mouth. Prominent, yellowed, and somewhat carious teeth gave the clerk a rabbity look, and Holmes knew that people tended to look away, or at least not look carefully at faces where prominent and poorly cared for teeth were on display. His cheeks were red, not with a flush, but with what seemed to be a permanent and unhealthy-looking reddish-pink rash. Another reason not to stare too closely. This bureaucrat, or clerk, was reading the midday Washington paper, and every time Holmes's prey looked back from where he was sitting near the front of this railway carriage, all the man would have seen was the raised paper. Holmes really did not want to spend this afternoon of March 27th, the same Monday on which he'd spent part of the morning revealing his identity to John Hay and Clarence King, tailing this man to New York, but he realized that it might be now or never. There was a complex spiderweb woven around the death of Clover Adams, and Holmes knew that before he could penetrate it, he would have to follow several of the strands, at least those of Clover's closest friends near the time of her death, to wherever they might lead. This one might well lead nowhere, and Holmes would rather have been spending his afternoon organizing the years of typewritten envelopes and correspondences that Hay had promised him. He also had to break into Henry Adams's mansion next door to the Hays. This would have to wait until after dark tomorrow night, Tuesday. Clara Hay had told him that Adams's servants, who'd been permitted a few days of holiday this extended weekend during Mr. Adams's extended absence, would be returning on Wednesday afternoon, the 29th of April, to begin the process of opening up and airing out the house in preparation for their master's return on Friday, the first day of May. So it was now or possibly never concerning following his man, and Holmes peered over the top of his raised newspaper and watched the broad back and head of short-cropped blonde hair. It was quite possible that his quarry might bolt out of the carriage at one of the many stops on this line to New York, and Holmes must be prepared to follow him at a second's notice, and to do so while looking casual about it. After almost 2 full years away, Holmes missed London. He missed his rooms at 221B Baker Street, and he missed Mrs. Hudson and even Watson, but mostly he missed the city. At one point, to prepare for his future profession as consulting detective, Holmes had spent a year driving a London hansom cab. He rather flattered himself that he knew every street, boulevard, thoroughfare, and alley in the city. More than that, Holmes had set his goal to memorize every business and manufactory and warehouse and noble townhouse in the city. A Herculean task, made even more impossible by the fact that, since the 1870s, old London was being torn down, torn up, and rebuilt in a crazed hurry like no other city on earth. Business establishments that may have stayed at the same address for a century and a half were suddenly out of business, or moved to much lesser surroundings because of the hurtling cost of rent, as the trendier neighborhoods in the city were fruitful and multiplied. Most importantly, Holmes knew the trains and times in general in England, and specifically in London. He and Watson had each worn out their respective Bradshaws, Mycroft Holmes, to the detective's chagrin, since his portly brother never really went anywhere, had memorized the National Bradshaw's Guide, and could give any timetable for any railway at any time of the day or night for any connections. Sherlock Holmes felt that Mycroft's little trick rather amounted to showing off. But at least in England,
Holmes always had his yellow-covered Bradshaws in his pocket or portmanteau. Here in America, he'd found nothing comparable to the great Bradshaw's Guide, only untrustworthy timetables for this specific railway company or that one. He could only hope that this train actually was going to New York City. While they rumbled north, Holmes thought about Henry Adams, the late Clover Adams, Clarence King, John Hay, and Clara Hay. They all held secrets relevant to Holmes's investigation, even Clover Adams. The dead, Holmes knew, hug their secrets tightly in the grave, but not as tightly as the living. He was aware that Henry James had known Clover Adams a long time, even before she had married Henry Adams. And Holmes had met few men in his life and career who hugged their secrets closer than did Henry James. But he already knew the secret of secrets that James would die to protect. They hadn't discussed it, of course, but both Sherlock Holmes the detective and Henry James the writer were celibate. Holmes had given up any plans for a romantic or a sexual life so that he could devote 100% of his time and vital energies to his career. If pressed, James would, Holmes knew, claim the same, and he'd already written that now, as an old bachelor, he should never marry because he was already married to his art. But Holmes knew that there was more to the story. There had been many attractive young women and men on the ship coming over from France, the men and women often walking the promenade deck arm in arm, men with men, women with women. The detective didn't know whether James played whist or poker or bridge or any other card game where concealment was a great part of the game, but he knew that James's impassive countenance would be an asset in such a competition. He showed little reaction, even to surprising statements or revelations. But once, unaware that Holmes was even looking his way, Henry James's gaze had paused for no more than a second on two loud, laughing, carefree young American men walking arm in arm along the deck in the way American men do so freely. And Holmes caught the complex flicker of reactions in James's gaze: envy, wistfulness, longing, and again that vague hunger. The hunger had not seemed primarily sexual in nature to Holmes's trained eye, but it was most certainly an emotional reaction. Holmes didn't care about this fact, only that it was James's deepest secret. That and some hidden shame about his health and back pains and relationship to his older brother William. And what made Holmes care even less was that it could not have had any direct bearing on either the serious business that had brought the detective to America or on this odd little case of Clover Adams's death. After far too many suburban stops, the train from Washington finally pulled into New York's Grand Central Depot at the junction of 42nd Street and Park Avenue. This three-story Victorian pile was not the new six-story Grand Central Station that both Holmes and James would see after the turn of the century, much less the Grand Central Terminal that would stand at the same spot from 1913 on for a century into the future. This Grand Central Depot, Holmes could see, was a hodgepodge wedding cake of a place, with dark portals opening for more rails that would allow a few horse-drawn trains to continue toward downtown Manhattan, and oversized signs for the New York and Harlem, New York and New Haven, and New York and Hudson River lines. Holmes's man, obviously familiar with the maze of connections here, hurried out of the stopped carriage, up flights of stairs, across a crowded open space, and outside, where he ran to catch a horse-drawn trolley headed down Park Avenue. There was nothing Holmes could do but run even harder, a solid sprint with his side whiskers flying and one hand holding his Homburg in place, and leap onto the trolley at the last second. If his prey looked back, he would be most obvious, but Holmes could see that the man he was following had already settled into a seat far forward on the trolley and was paying no attention to anything but the newspaper he'd opened in front of him. Holmes knew that his man belonged to several rather elite, for Americans, clubs, including two where he kept a room, the Union Club at 69th Street and Park Avenue, and the Century Club at 42 East 15th Street. The man also had a permanent room at the Brunswick Hotel at Madison Square at Fifth Avenue and 25th Street. Holmes knew that the Union Club was not the immediate destination because his target stayed on the slow trolley as the horses took it further south on Park Avenue. The Union Club's 69th Street and Park Avenue address obviously would mean that Holmes's man would have gone north from Grand Central Terminus at 42nd Street. The same applied to his quarry's rooms at the Century Club, since that elite institution had recently moved to 7 West 43rd Street, which would also have required a turn north from the terminal. If the man he was following was heading toward the Brunswick Hotel, where Holmes knew he kept a permanent room, he should get off the trolley no further south than 25th Street, since the Brunswick was two blocks east where 5th Avenue crossed 25th Street. But the man, hunched over slightly and seeming lost in the afternoon edition of the New York paper he'd picked up at Grand Central, stayed on the trolley past both the 25th and then 23rd Street stops. So the destination wasn't the Union Club, the Century Club, or his much-frequented Brunswick Hotel. At Union Square, the trolley took the slight jog to avoid the transition from Park Avenue to Broadway and followed 4th Avenue for five blocks to Lafayette Street. Holmes's man showed no interest in getting off anywhere along these blocks just above and below Canal Street. When Lafayette Street merged with Center Street and City Hall came within view, the man stood on the running board to hop off the trolley. Holmes let the horses plod on another half block before he also jumped off and doubled back through the throng of pedestrians, keeping his target's head and shoulders in view at all times. Holmes immediately saw their destination and was a little surprised. He'd imagined that if they were going to cross the East River, that his quarry would take one of the ferries. The fact that they weren't going to a ferry landing pleased Holmes. He'd been in New York City several times since the Brooklyn Bridge was finished a decade earlier in 1883, but he'd never had reason or opportunity to cross it before. As with Henry James a week and a half earlier, a ferry had always seemed a more reasonable way to make the switch of railway connections from Manhattan to Staten Island or Brooklyn. He watched his man pay his toll at the ornamental iron toll booth and climb the broad iron stairway to the waiting platform. Half a dozen heads behind him in the queue, Holmes paid his nickel and joined the crowd on the platform. The train cars crossing the bridge followed their course in the center of the span with the pedestrian walkway above it and the roadbeds for carriages and other conveyances running along on either side. And Holmes knew that the trains made no stops on the bridge. Thus, he felt perfectly comfortable taking a seat and relaxing in the rear of the car his man had entered, his back to his quarry. He could see reflections of the front of the car in nearby windows, but it would be difficult, not to mention senseless, for his target to jump from one of the train cars in mid-span. Holmes noted for future reference, although he doubted he'd ever have a case concerning the Brooklyn Bridge railway cars, that the cars were very much like the newest and most luxurious cars on New York's elevated trains. Double sliding doors opening from open platforms decorated with elaborately worked wrought iron, comfortable rows of seats, and large windows. New Yorkers and Brooklynites had long since grown accustomed to the fact that the cars had no engines pulling or pushing them, but the occasional tourist exclaimed when their car began moving smoothly away from the station, seemingly under its own power. Holmes knew that down under the rails there was an ever-moving steel traction cable that the cars hooked onto for motivation. Holmes knew that San Francisco had a much more elaborate web of cable cars and that the grades were much steeper there. Still, one could feel this Brooklyn Bridge car climbing up the visible grade of the suspended roadways and superstructure. Sherlock Holmes was not a man who usually went out of his way to be impressed either by works of nature or works of man. The latter he found largely irrelevant to his work, except for the layouts of interior murder scenes and the like. The former he always considered ephemeral in terms of the expanse of time and mankind's tiny part in it. Holmes had studied his Darwin when he was a boy, and it had left him not only with the feeling that he and everyone he might know had their place in the world, and then would know it no more in a blink of an eye, but even the pyramids and other great works were as ephemeral as a castle of sand on the beach at Brighton. So cathedrals and great buildings of any age did not move Sherlock Holmes to any level of emotion, with the few exceptions such as London Bridge or Big Ben, the latter heard more often than seen through the city's deadly fogs. They were touchstones of the city he worked in his own rigidly controlled way, loved. But now, looking up, Holmes had to admit that the stone towers of the Brooklyn Bridge they were just passing under the first one set out in the river were impressive indeed. For many decades, the tallest structure in New York City had been the spire of Trinity Church at 284 feet. Just 3 years earlier, New York's World Building at the corner of Park Row and Franklin Street became the tallest structure in the city at 309 feet. And while this stone arch in the tower that the train was presently passing through was only 117 feet, and the height of the towers only 159 feet above the roadways and rail tracks, 276 and a half feet above the river itself, the sheer stone Gothic strength of the towers impressed the unimpressionable Holmes to some degree. Holmes knew that remembering such precise numbers was just a waste of his precious mental attic space. Remembering the heights of the arches and towers and roadway of this bridge would almost certainly never help him in a case. But he'd encountered the information during one of his many sleepless nights spent reading one of the 25 volumes of his newer 1889 ninth edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Watson had called that purchase a foolish waste of money, since Holmes already owned the sixth and eighth editions, but Holmes treasured his ninth edition. Unfortunately, and although his brother Mycroft was the one with the amazing mathematical abilities, once Sherlock Holmes was exposed to facts in the form of numbers, he found it all but impossible to forget them. This seemingly miraculous bridge, supported by cables, descending from two stone towers that rose 276 feet above the river. America, he thought, and not for the first time, is a nation with huge dreams and not infrequently the ability to realize them. Meanwhile, the car descended the grade beyond the second tower and slowed as it approached the Brooklyn terminal, even more of an elaborate and painted iron structure than on the New York side. With a gentle release of the ingenious Payne's grip device freeing them from the cable. Holmes knew about Colonel W.H. Payne's gripping releasing device only because he'd been hired in the mid-1880s by one of Payne's executives to look into a patent infringement of the grip, then in use only in San Francisco, by a would-be cable car company in Paris. Holmes followed his man down onto the street and then to a short series of horse-drawn trolley rides, finally walking half a block behind the man as he strolled southeast down a rough cobblestoned extension of Flatbush Avenue. His target never looked back over his shoulder or paused at a window front to check in the reflection to see if he was being followed. Brooklyn, Holmes vaguely knew, had once been, save for Irish and Negro areas along the river to the north, a wealthy and self-satisfied city of wide, leaf-shaded avenues and many stately homes. The neighborhood they were in now, not that far from where they had demolished so many old structures to allow for the approaches to the bridge, was far from stately. An apparently self-respecting three-story home, its trim and siding brightly painted in the most popular current colors of rose or aqua or mint green or sunset orange, might have on either side of it a run-down old structure whose inhabitants had abandoned all efforts at repair or upkeep. It was at one of the nicer homes on Hudson Street that Holmes's man bounded up the four front steps, unlocked the front door, shouted something that Holmes could not quite hear from his place more than a half a block away, and was immediately engulfed in hugs from two little girls and a woman with a babe in arms. The girls and babe and woman were Negroes, the woman especially ebony in color. The two girls in clean white shifts were lighter shades of tan in complexion, but had kinky hair carefully brushed, braided, and tied up in fresh ribbons. There was no doubt that this was an affectionate homecoming. This surprised Holmes a bit. The man Holmes had been tailing all day was white.
"Yeah, they got three children. The two older ones are girls," said Mrs. Baines, the woman with a missing front tooth. The littlest one, the baby's a boy. They had a boy before. He was there first, but he died,
said Mrs. Youngfeld, an older woman with gray hair. It was her house across the street on Hudson.
They named the first boy, the one who died, Leroy.
Le roi, thought Holmes. The king.
Holmes had lost the excessive facial hair, wig, and prominent front teeth, and parted his own hair in the middle with a generous use of hair cream. He now wore thick but frameless spectacles. There were 7 pencils visible in his left jacket pocket. From his briefcase, he had produced an oversized ledger filled with what looked to be official forms. It was late, and several homes on Hudson Street had not responded to his knocking, a white man knocking in what was obviously a colored neighborhood. But Mrs. Youngfeld and her visitor and good friend from down the street, Mrs. Baines, had peeked through the sidelights and decided that the prissy-looking Holmes was not a threatening character. They'd had no interest when Holmes had explained that his name was Mr. Williams and he was taking a local census so that the Brooklyn Benevolent Neighborhood Association could upgrade local parks and facilities. But when he'd brought out the $2 he'd pay each of them in return for their brief time answering a few questions about their neighbors, they warmed to him.
"And the family's name is Todd?" said Holmes, pursing his lips and fussing with the complex form of boxes and printed lines on the leaves of paper in his ledger.
"That's right," said Mrs. Youngfeld. "James and Ada Todd. You want the children's names, too?"
"I don't believe that will be necessary," said Holmes. "But you say there are the 2 girls and 1 baby boy in the household."
"Another baby on the way," said Mrs. Baines. "Ada told me that their whole house there is getting too small for them."
"Would you happen to know their ages? Approximate ages will suffice."
Holmes was speaking with a slight whistling lisp through his permanently pursed lips. He was a government bureaucrat who liked being a government bureaucrat, a charge he'd once, in pique, leveled at his brother Mycroft, who had responded at once in his slow, unexcitable drawl,
"But, brother, I do not work for the British government. At times, I am the British government."
"Mr. Todd, he about 51, 52. Ada's going to be 32 this coming April 9, said Mrs. Youngfeld.
Holmes made no comment on the disparity of ages. He'd seen that with his own eyes in the failing light of evening.
"And would you have any idea of when they were married?"
asked Holmes, pursing and whistling ever so slightly. Just another line to fill, just another box to check.
"What's it matter to the benevolent whatever of Brooklyn when a legally married couple got married?"
demanded Mrs. Baines. Her hands were now fists, and her fists were on her bony hips.
"September 22, 1888, said Mrs. Youngfeld.
Mrs. Baines turned a wide-eyed stare on her friend.
"Ella, how do you know that? The exact date that Ada got hitched? I can't even remember my own anniversary." "I remember numbers and dates," said Mrs. Youngfeld. "Toddy, your anniversary is on December 14. Not that it matters since Henry run off 4 years ago."
Mrs. Baines looked away and stomped her foot.
"Ada told me that she and James got married over in New York at her aunt's place on West 24th Street,"
Mrs. Youngfeld continued to Holmes, who scribbled quickly to keep up.
"She said they brought a colored Methodist minister down from a church on 85th Street to do the ceremony. They had an organ brought in to play and a cake with white icing."
Mrs. Baines stared daggers at her friend, but said nothing.
"Almost done here," said Holmes. "Mr. James Todd's occupation. He is employed by the gas works?"
"No, you got that wrong," laughed Mrs. Baines. "Ada's man, James, is a railroad porter, originally from Baltimore. A head porter. He works for the New York Central Railroad. But poor Ada, the railroad keeps sending him all over the place. Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, Massachusetts. even up into some places in Canada. Ontario and Quebec,
said Mrs. Youngfeld.
Wherever they send him, he's gone a whole bunch of the time,
said Mrs. Baines, clearly exasperated at her friend and neighbor's vast store of information.
Ada's home alone, expecting again, alone all by her own self with the two girls and the baby boy to take care of most of the time. That man may make good money as a chief porter, but he's not home 2 days out of 50.
I shan't take up any more of your time, ladies, said Holmes, putting away his ledger and adjusting his glasses on his nose. You've been most helpful. Your census information on the Todds and other neighbors may well enable the Brooklyn Benevolent Neighborhood Association to fund a fine playground near here.
The children's got plenty of empty lots round here to play in, said Mrs. Baines. What we really could use is a nice, clean, respectable saloon, like the ones that used to be up on Flatbush Avenue before the bridge squashed everything. Oh, hush up, Toddy, said Mrs. Youngfeld.
Looking Holmes in the eye, she said,
She doesn't mean that, Mr. Williams.
Holmes nodded, raised his hat, backed down to the sidewalk level, made as if to turn away, but then turned back to the two women.
You'll forgive me if this question is insensitive. It is supposed to be part of the neighborhood census, but I rarely have to ask it.
The two ladies waited.
Coincidentally, I have had the occasion to see Mr. James Todd without having the pleasure of actually making his acquaintance,
Holmes said softly, showing visible signs of embarrassment.
The gentleman has blue eyes, blonde hair, not much left, but definitely blonde, and a very fair complexion.
Mrs. Baines laughed heartily.
So he fooled you too,
she said, the missing tooth even more visible in an otherwise perfect wide expanse of white teeth.
Fooled,
began Holmes.
James Todd is passing,
said Mrs. Youngfeld. She also sounded embarrassed.
He told Ada that he's been passing since he was a boy.
Oh, yes,
said Mrs. Baines, still laughing.
James Todd, he good at passing.
Passing?
Said Holmes.
You mean passing as
white,
said Mrs. Youngfeld.
James Todd doesn't look black, but his wife Ada told us a dozen times that his grandpa and mama were field slaves down in Carolina. Lots of segregation going on with those field slaves, and lots of children of those segregations trying to pass up here, though not many looks as white as James Todd. At least he kept to his own kind in marrying,
said Mrs. Baines. Holmes tipped his hat a final time.
Thank you again, ladies.
On the late night train back to Washington, Holmes realized he was very tired. Tomorrow would be busy because he would have the mystery of who sent the annual She Was Murdered cards solved by afternoon, and he would have to break into Henry Adams's mansion after dark. Always a delicate proposition in such a swanky and well-policed area as the Hayes and Adamses had chosen to live in. He knew one of the original Five of Hearts' secrets now. Mr. Clarence King, America's most eligible bachelor, according to his friend John Hay and an editorial writer in Century Magazine, had been married to a colored woman named Ada Copeland since September 1888. There seemed no doubt, at least to his neighbors, that the two girls, living baby boy, deceased baby boy named Leroy, and baby on the way, were all his. And Holmes himself had noticed how light-skinned the baby and one of the girls had been, especially when compared to their attractive ebony mother. Uncovering one such secret of the Five of Hearts was a start, Holmes knew, but there remained secrets he would have to ferret out of John and Clara Hayes' lives, of Henry Adams, and even of the late Clover Adams. Every man or woman alive, Holmes knew, had secrets. Most, like Clarence King, deliberately misleading his closest friends with his boisterous talk of being attracted only to swarthy South Sea Island beauties. Had secrets
within secrets. A few, like Henry James and Holmes himself, had secrets within secrets within secrets. One of Holmes's small secrets had asserted itself before he left Brooklyn. It had been too many hours since that early morning's injection of the heroic drug, and before Holmes took a ferry across the river back to Grand Central Terminus, he found an empty shed in Brooklyn in which he could cook up his little solution of heroin and inject it with some privacy. He'd been in pain, both physical and psychological, for the entire afternoon, and the relief in the moment after the injection was heaven sent. Now Holmes closed his eyes and literally nodded off as the train rushed south through the night. Chapter 20.
My dear Harry, cried John Hay, you simply cannot desert me now.
Not deserting, surely, said Henry James, merely drawing a polite boundary to my intrusion, despite your and Clara's generous and obviously boundary-less hospitality. You remember that you helped find a room for me to rent near here in 1883, when I was here last and visiting the Adamses.
But that's quite different, said Hay.
Both men were standing in Hay's study this Tuesday morning. Hay had informed James that the servants had reported Mr. Sigerson, hat brim low and collars high, coming in and retiring to his room not long before dawn.
We have Holmes and his mysteries now, continued Hay. This is all simply too fascinating to face alone. You must share this excitement with us.
I apologize again for bringing the detective here in disguise and under false pretenses, began James.
Nonsense, cried Hay, waving away the apology with his long, elegant fingers. It's a profoundly exciting experience, and one that I wouldn't have missed for the world. Look at what he's had my secretaries doing all yesterday afternoon and this morning.
James looked at the boxes of envelopes and cards which covered every desk and table surface in the study. Surely you are not going to allow this stranger to read your personal and business correspondence, said James. He was unable to keep his sense of shock out of his voice. Hay laughed.
Of course not, my dear Harry. These are envelopes and cards with typed addresses only, although he will be comparing the first line or so of some harmless correspondence to the ominous cards all of us in the Five of Hearts receive annually. All these addresses and notes have been typewritten, you see. Holmes told me yesterday morning that, and I believe I quote him correctly, a typewriter has really quite as much individuality as a man's handwriting. James made a non-committal sound. So you really must stay, repeated Hay. I need your advice and ready counsel, old friend. It will be a very sensitive thing when Adams gets home.
It will indeed, said James. You have no intention of...
telling him that the English detective Sherlock Holmes is investigating Clover's suicide? Finished Hay. Certainly not. You know as well as I that Henry will never agree to discuss that terrible December day. Adams would be outraged and appalled at the very idea of a detective poking around amidst the burned rubble of his painful memories.
We can only hope, said James, that what Adams does not know doesn't end up somehow hurting him anyway. Lies and omissions have a way of getting out, especially among close friends. Hay frowned at this in silence for a long moment, but finally said,
The real question is whether to tell Clara about all this. By odd coincidence, she's a great collector of the published tales of our new friend's so-called adventures.
Tell Clara about what?
Asked Clara Hay from the door that had been quietly opened while the two men had been so loudly debating. Leaving his room locked, James took his umbrella, despite the fact that the skies were perfectly blue this warming Tuesday in March, and set off on what Hay had told him was a walk of about 2 miles to the U.S. Capitol and its Library of Congress. Hay had added that if Harry wanted to see the beautiful new Thomas Jefferson building, currently under construction, to house the enlarged library in a few years, he might add a block or so to his walk to view the rising front facade facing 2nd Street northeast. James felt bad telling his friend Hay that he simply wanted to get in some exercise and a spot of sightseeing when, in truth, he had a much more sinister reason for visiting the Library of Congress installed in the Capitol building. The previous afternoon, Henry James had done what was almost certainly the least gentlemanly act of his adult life. The maids were cleaning Mr. Sigerson's room when James went upstairs that afternoon. They were carrying out sheets and fetching new ones while airing out the room of a visible miasma of pipe smoke, and they'd left the door ajar. James had paused and peered in. Holmes had bustled out earlier, working to hide his appearance with a derby pulled low and a Macintosh collar tugged high, but almost certainly had been in some disguise. There was no telling when he might return. His room, the bedding being dealt with first by the maids, was a mess. Clothes flung on the floor, books strewn everywhere,